Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with what appears to be a new Obama military intelligence doctrine emerging that builds upon the Libyan example of intervention without boots on the ground. The founder and editor of SomaliaReport.com, Robert Young Pelton, joins us to discuss a new war going on in Somalia that employs U.S. naval and air assets, including drones, but uses Kenyan and Ugandan boots on the ground to fight the Islamist al-Shabaab militia. Then we'll talk about the national revival of Sinclair Lewis's novel and play It Can't Happen Here, a prophetic warning from the 1930s of how fascism could take over in the United States, opening now in performances and readings across the country. The organizer of this political and literary awakening, author, actor, and comedian Daryl Henriquez, joins us along with Professor Joel Schechter, who teaches dramatic literature criticism and theater history. We will discuss similarities between today's economic hard times and political extremism and the era in which It Can't Happen Here was written and performed by actors who actually worked for the United States government under the WPA, the Works Progress Administration. Then finally, we'll speak with British historian and author Robert Lacey, the author of Inside the Kingdom, Kings, Clerics, Modernists, Terrorists, and the Struggle for Saudi Arabia. As the Cold War between Saudis and Iranians heats up, we will discuss the paradox that as rebellious Arab youth drive the region towards liberalism and reform, the ruling gerontocracy in Saudi Arabia appears to be heading in the opposite direction. Joining us now is Robert Young Pelton, an author, filmmaker, journalist, and explorer. He is the founder and publisher of SomaliaReport.com. Robert Young Pelton has had first-hand perspective on the war on terror from direct contact with the world's most infamous jihadi, rebel, and insurgent groups. His books include The World's Most Dangerous Places, Come Back Alive, Three Worlds Gone Mad, License to Kill, Hired Guns in the War on Terror, and his autobiography, The Adventurist. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Young Pelton.
Always a pleasure, Ian.
And it does seem that we have a new war front, if you will, in Somalia and Kenya. And we just apparently sent troops into Uganda. Many people think that was a payoff for the extent to which Ugandan troops have been dragooned into helping the U.S. out in Somalia. You published SomaliaReport.com, which is the most comprehensive and thorough analysis of what's going on in that beleaguered and war-torn country. Give us an update on what's happening there on the border with Kenya.
Yeah, well, what's happened is that the Kenyan military has gone into Somalia through its southern border, which neighbors with Kenya. And as you know, Kenya's had a number of problems, not just with the recent kidnapping, but with years of incursions by Somali. So they are, I think, well justified in going into that border after the kidnap of the two aid workers, two tourists, one of which died in captivity. The interesting thing, though, is that they're also coordinating this attack with some aviation and naval assets supplied by France and the U.S., and both these countries deny having any activity or participation in it. And the third, more complex thing is that the TFG, which is the temporary government or transitional government in Mogadishu, has now come out against the Kenyan incursion, even though they approved it and met with these people before it happened. So it's kind of like a three-ring circus.
But just a little bit of history, though. During the George W. Bush administration, the United States came up with this idea that the best way to break al-Shabaab and its alleged connection to al-Qaeda in Somalia was to use the Ethiopians and U.S. special forces, along with the Ethiopian army, invaded Somalia. And that turned out to be a total disaster, surely, because of the traditional enmity between Somalis and Ethiopians. So
that's correct. In 2006, the Ethiopians, using sort of Soviet-style artillery and tanks and U.S. air support, went in, pushed out the ICU, the Islamic fundamentalist units there, and then created al-Shabaab, which is sort of an al-Qaeda-sponsored kind of mutation of what we would call the Taliban in Afghanistan or the ICU in Somalia. But the interesting thing is that al-Shabaab is a very tiny, sort of unsynchronized group of fundamentalists. So they had a stranglehold in Mogadishu. They were kicked out of there. They basically fled from Mogadishu. They used Kismayo, which is a small port in the southern part of Somalia, to fund most of their activities. The Kenyans are going for Kismayo. They're going to cut Al-Shabaab off from their source of income, and hopefully they'll squeeze them between the Ugandan soldiers, which the U.S. pays via the U.N. to fight Al-Shabaab in Mogadishu, and the Kenyan army. What happens next, though, is the big question.
And what is the status, then, of some of these kidnappings? Because two Westerners were seized in northern Somalia, and they've been, of course, you mentioned earlier, the Kenyans responding to kidnapping. Two Spanish staff workers for Médecins Sans Frontières were grabbed in northern Kenya. So what's the latest in terms of the latest abduction? Because I think an American aid worker from a Christian aid group has been kidnapped, hasn't he?
The gal that was kidnapped is 32 years old. She used to be a fourth grade teacher in Rosslyn, Virginia. The other gentleman is a Danish manager of the Danish demining group that works out of, usually out of Hargeisa, but they've got an office in Nairobi. They had just finished giving a class and were on their way to the airport when their own security team kidnapped them. And we've been tracking them on Somali Report, and we've been talking to the people who are holding them and the people that kidnapped them. So it seems like this is not connected to the Al-Qaeda and Al-Shabaab kidnappings in the south. The three kidnappings in the south, we think, are part of a plan that was hatched by Al-Qaeda earlier on to disrupt the tourism industry and to essentially lure Western troops into Somalia.
So if that's their plan, are we falling for a sucker punch, or are they made a mistake?
Well, unfortunately, the Kenyans might have fallen for a sucker punch. There are no U.S. troops in Somalia. There are some CIA-paid Americans that are training, and of course there's French intelligence agents and other people. But we are, when I say we, the United States has learned quite a few lessons from Libya and other wars to keep out. I mean, to make this look like a local fight, even though we're paying for them and providing intelligence support and logistical support and financial support.
So what then are the possibilities? I've been seeing reports, Robert Young-Pilton, that this could be the death blow against Al-Shabaab. They're not that big and they're not that powerful, but they're fairly tenacious, aren't they?
Yeah, this would be the death blow against Al-Shabaab as a military organization. They are going to morph into a terrorist organization. And as you've seen from the two grenade attacks in Nairobi and the previous attacks in Uganda and some of the car bombs in Mogadishu, they're going to simply resort to Taliban-type tactics where they don't fight on a front, per se, but they will continue to do suicide attacks, bomb attacks, IED attacks against what they consider to be foreign occupiers.
And Robert Young-Pilton, again, founder and publisher of SomaliaReport.com. The American aid worker kidnapped along with the Danish demining specialist. She wasn't with the Danish demining group, but it does make you wonder what kind of country we're dealing with. Getting rid of mines, you think, would be in everybody's interests.
Well, and being kidnapped by confuse criminal and political acts. This is a criminal act.
I see. So the fact that their own bodyguards kidnapped them, that says it all, right?
Well, just a little background. The pirates are not doing very well. If you read Somali Report, some of the reports we've done show very clearly that their cash flow is down. They're getting desperate. They've essentially put out orders for anyone who can find a Westerner. They usually bring about $400,000 to $500,000 in ransom. So we think this is a pirate group we know very well that's based out of Habyo and Whistle. They're currently holding a crew of the MV Leopard, and they need more money. So they're willing to compensate people if they can deliver Westerners to them.
So the word is out then. Just you grab a Westerner and you got a customer.
Just like a menu, you're worth $400,000 because the ships bring in about $4.5 million, but they're getting harder and harder for them to grab. And as they hold them for longer and longer periods, it cuts into their cash flow. So they're trying to make a quick bump with these kidnappings. And like I said, the jury's still out on whether the southern kidnappings, which was the French lady who died, the English lady who died, and the two aid workers who are still alive, whether these were just criminal motivations, because we've tracked the Miss Tebbit to the same area in central Somalia. So we think it's a combination of both terrorist and also financial gain attacks.
And Robert Young-Pelton, again, founder and publisher of SomaliaReport.com. When you just mentioned that the pirates aren't doing as well as they have in the past in terms of kidnapping and ransoming, apparently that was a fairly sophisticated operation in the sense that transactions were done abroad and there are brokers abroad. And I've never understood why it is that, you know, we've captured a couple of pirates, killed a couple of pirates, and there's an awful lot of naval assets out there chasing pirates. But why not go after the middlemen and paymasters?
Well, because the insurance industry condones the payment of ransom. Their logic is that the pirates fully intend to give you back your personal property and people's lives, so payment of a ransom is just expediting that. They don't look at it as supporting this industry. But I have to say this, that the Navy only has about 25 ships in the region, but they've been very successful in both tracking the pirates before they head out on shore and keeping them away from ships. The shipping industry, I was just in Sweden talking at a convention of maritimers, have done a very good job of hardening their ships and being on the lookout for them. And the actual pirates themselves, there's over 1,000 pirates in jails around the world and 750 waiting for trial. And the locals have taken up arms and kicked the pirates out. So I honestly think that piracy is on the decline now, but it doesn't mean it's over.
And you were just there on, didn't you take a ship from Somalia to Aden in Yemen?
Other way around. I went from the UAE to Somalia on what they call the love boat. It was a ship that was going to be sent to be scrapped, but I wanted to experience firsthand what it's like to sail through the Indian Ocean and the Gulf of Aden. And there were a number of attacks while we were at sea, but nobody wanted to attack my ship. But once again, it's just important to see just how big the ocean is and how many pirates are out there.
And you could see that they were?
Well, yeah, they scout you out. There's a number of small fishing vessels many, many miles offshore. They scout you out. You can see them off in the distance, and they're looking for a certain kind of vessel, a certain what they call low and slow, something that travels under 15 or 12 knots and something that's got a low freeboard so they can get their ladders over the side. And they're finding less and less of those. And, of course, the prevalence of armed security on ships, which is essentially the rebirth of the security business we saw in Iraq and Afghanistan, is also preventing a number of piracy attacks. Almost 90% of piracy attacks are prevented by armed guards.
So they didn't go after your ship because it was heading for the scrap heap? Is that...
We had a high freeboard. It's a 160-meter ship that would have taken about, I don't know, maybe 18, 20 feet to get over the side. Mm-hmm. It didn't stop them from checking us out, but, you know, at the end of the day, they'll go for easy pickings.
So tell me about the U.S.'s, you mentioned earlier that the U.S. is adopting a new strategic approach here to these small wars in the sense that maybe Libya has proven to be an example for, I take it, the National Security Council, the President, Secretary of State. Mm-hmm. New head of CIA, General Petraeus, are they figuring that the model worked in Libya and we can expand it elsewhere and keep our fingerprints off, keep the boots off the ground?
Yeah, absolutely. And this is, by the way, this is not new. This is actually very old. Using proxy forces was how the British expanded their empire and how we used to do business in many countries. You find local insurgents, you train them, you support them, you create a coalition, but you don't call it a coalition of the willing. You basically find enough people. In the case of France and Italy and all these people, they are the ones that were suffering the most from the potential cutoff of oil. So we essentially provided the support for the attacks in Libya. And if you look at the film footage out of Libya, one has to wonder where all those people got all those weapons very quickly and how all those airstrikes hit certain targets. It's because they had people on the ground doing that. In Somalia, we have even less interest in putting Americans on there because of Black Hawk Down. But it's a very geostrategic point, and it still is a safe haven for terrorism. So what you're seeing is working with France, working with local neighbors like Uganda, Ethiopia, and Kenya, we can build up their forces, train them, and then send them in, help them with the intel, help them with the coordination and deconfliction, and then let them take the credit for kicking al-Shabaab out.
And so what is the U.S.'s base in Djibouti all about? Because that's apparently a pretty substantial base with I don't know how many U.S. forces. I think they also share it with the French, and I take it that a lot of the drone activity in Yemen comes out of there, doesn't it?
Yeah, Camp Lemagne is originally a French Foreign Legion base with about 2,500 French people. We have about 1,500 Americans there. It was set up as part of what they call CJOTF HOA, you know, Horn of Africa. Special operation troops have been based out of there since 2002. The drone program just came up to speed in Somalia, but yes, it became a big spot for launching drone strikes in Yemen. The biggest problem was they couldn't get enough Reapers, which are the long-distance, heavy payload drones. There is an active drone program in southern Somalia against Al-Qaeda and Al-Shabaab. They fly some of those out of the Seychelles, but there's also a lot of Navy support. The USS Enterprise is offshore there. We have a number of destroyers and naval ships. We also have massive aviation capability through satellites and other high-tech things. So we're not invisible, but we're definitely not on the ground, but we're providing a very robust support for getting rid of terrorism in the region.
So you mentioned Robert Young-Pelton, again, publisher and founder of SomaliaReport.com. You mentioned that we're now operating drones out of the Seychelles. That's quite a distance, isn't it, to Somalia?
Yeah, but a drone, I don't have the facts in front of me, but if you go on Somalia Report, you can see my report called Enter the Drones, which gives you the specifics. You buy drones in a pack of four. They go out for almost 12 hours at a time. They can cover almost 1,000 miles, and you replace them as they come back for fuel. You send another one up. But then you can also coordinate with Navy ships. Don't forget, you can you can launch carriers off of the Enterprise and drop strikes that way. The Predators have to be armed with Mavericks. You can only get a couple of good hits in, so it's a little bit more complicated. But right now you're seeing a combination of both naval bombardment, which are just basically ships from France and the U.S. firing guns. You're seeing drone strikes, which you can't hear or see drones, but because of that, people assume they're drone strikes. And you see also aviation strikes from both Kenya, who has some MiGs, and other allied air forces.
But the Reaper that you mentioned, that's a bigger drone, right, that has more firepower and
longer range as well, yeah.
Right. So there's a lot of activity going on here, clearly.
And the reason why I got into Somalia, I've done similar news services in Iraq and Afghanistan. The reason I moved to Somalia is because that's where we're going to be. That is the most geostrategic point on the map. And we involved in Iran in much the same way, with naval support, air support, but no sort of troop support, which is also why I think Obama was pulling troops out of Iraq as fast as he can, because he doesn't want them close enough to Iran for retribution.
So we're pulling out of Iraq, but we're escalating activities against Iran?
So internally, we've been supporting insurgent groups and ethnic groups for a very long time, obviously since the 70s when they took over the embassy. But we've always been pushing, when I say we, the State Department, not me, has been pushing a lot of items into the news stream about how bad and evil Iran is, whether it's this assassination plot to kill a Saudi prince or providing EFPs against our troops in Iraq. They just keep the drum beat up. And the Navy and the Air Force hasn't had a good war, and they've got a lot of munitions, and it's very easy to access that country from either land bases or sea bases. So that's what I'm predicting.
So, in other words, Robert Young-Pelton, the Obama administration has a very, very robust and active national security menu out there. They're not just sitting down and reacting. They're being proactive. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. I mean, if you want to do it the very easy way, take a map of the world, circle all the countries that are considered rogue regimes, and you would have seen that Iraq was one of them, Afghanistan under the Taliban was one of them, Libya was one of them, and there's only a couple left. You've got North Korea and you've got Iran, and that's pretty much it to clean up most of the politics in the Northern Hemisphere.
So how is the U.S. going to take on Iran without boots on the ground and fingerprints? Who's going to do the heavy lifting?
You've seen Libya, and you've seen that a combination of airstrikes, literally thousands of airstrikes, and a quickly assembled mob of people with anti-aircraft guns on the back of pickup trucks can do some serious damage. And Iran's military is very Soviet style. You know, it's very easy to pick them off using some of the smart weapons we have. So what you'd see is sort of a replay of what happened in Iraq, where almost most of Iran's Navy and military forces and Air Force would vanish. They'd be blown up, leaving it open to the ground troops to duke it out in a very messy sort of partisan-type war.
But who would be the U.S. surrogate in terms of the rebels in Iran?
You know, just you got to go to Washington cocktail parties and see who the flavor of the month is. They have been supporting diaspora and expat groups who are opposed to the Iranian mullahs for a very, very long time.
Mm-hmm. So that you think that this is all being ramped up now? I mean, in other words, as far as Petraeus now, the head of the CIA and Obama and company are concerned, Libya worked, and this is the model to build on, and then the next target is Iran.
Right, because Iran is the last domino, for lack of a better word, in the sort of chain of dictators in that region and rogue regimes. It's an oil-rich country. It borders a number of very strategic partners, whether it's Turkey or Afghanistan or Iraq. It is constantly known as a disturber, for trying to be polite, and it's very easy to topple. There are a number of very disaffected groups inside that country. We've been working with a number of these ethnic and also religious minorities to create a very messy democracy, just like Libya. Things are not pretty, and because we can blame it on them or give them the credit, we don't lose any political points because we've got dead soldiers, and nobody sees the secret budgets or the air flights, so the journalists don't cover the war. And I was surprised during the whole Libyan conflict how little the U.S. was dragged into it, because they were essentially invisible.
But you're one of the few people that actually have gone to Somalia. And talk about an invisible country. Nobody wants to go there, right? And yet we're ramping up a war there, too.
Well, the war is on. I mean, it's not ramping up. But what we've done is create enough proxy forces, either by hiring Ugandans at $1,200 a pop through the U.N., or supporting Kenyan troop training, or just supporting the sort of the political process. We're setting the stage. It's called putting the frog out of the pot. If you keep heating the water up slowly, nobody notices until it gets too hot, and then the frog hops out. And that's really the new political strategy.
Well, I thank you for joining us, Robert Young Pelton. Interesting conversation.
It is my pleasure, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Robert Young Pelton, an author, filmmaker, journalist, and explorer. He's the founder and publisher of SomaliaReport.com. Robert Young Pelton has had firsthand perspective on the war on terror from direct contact with the world's most infamous jihadi, rebel, and insurgents groups. His books include The World's Most Dangerous Places, Come Back Alive, Three Worlds Gone Mad, License to Kill, Hired Guns in the War on Terror, and his autobiography, The Adventurist. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back in a moment.
Puppets, I'm a shaggy.